Namaste and blessings. May your richness and joy increase. Welcome to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. This Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Today, we continue our exploration of a text called the Authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj, who is the guru of this Swami. He was the one who made this Swami a Swami. This text is the full 352 verses, or shlokas, of the Sanskrit text, Sri Guru Gita, the Song of the Guru. The translation from the original Sanskrit was done by Acharya Padma Najendra, and the commentary was written by Swami Anantananda Giri. And it is this Swami's definite joy and privilege to present this to you. If you have not heard the episodes leading up to this, it would probably be worth your time to go visit www.type1radio.com and begin with Guru Gita number one. We've gone through three. Today we begin Guru Gita number four. And just as a basic catch up, what's occurring in the Guru Gita is Shiva's wife, Parvati, has observed Shiva bowing to something. Well, she's never seen anything quite like that before. All the demons, all the gods, even Vishnu and Brahma bow to Shiva. What would he be bowing to? So she's completely perplexed. And she wants to know, how can this happen? You're Shiva, the god of gods. Who do you bow to? And this is how the Guru Gita is set up. From number 27, Shiva says, that guru whose two lotus feet liberate one from all sense of duality, who helps one to cross over the ocean of samsara, to him I offer my prostrations. Let us discuss guru's feet in the commentary here. The individual chakras of the chakra system of the human body are often referred to as lotuses. Chakra literally means wheel in English, so named because they are said to be spinning vortexes of energy. They are said to both permit entry of energy into and expulsion of energy from the individual subtle body. In referring to the guru's feet as lotus feet, they are being equated to something that is a universal symbol of beauty, the lotus flower. Simultaneously, we're being told something about the nature of how a certain energy that is beneficial to the disciple travels through the astral and physical bodies of the guru. Finally, it is at the feet of the guru that disciples have traditionally sat in order to receive the teachings. It is to the feet of the guru that the disciple bows as a gesture of supplication, a gesture whose imitation can be observed in any interaction between any worldly ruler and his or her subjects. This is a symbol, a metaphor, acknowledging the disciples' high esteem for the guru's will, which should be treated as more important and more advanced than his or her own. Number 28, Shiva says to Parvati, because of your deserving status, I will tell you this secret. The embodied soul can rid himself of all sins by serving the feet of the guru. The commentary. The actions of people are generally carried out under the assumption that one's identity is limited to the body-mind complex. As such, their actions are generally motivated by the egocentric drive to satisfy one desire or another, or to avoid something that they are averse to. All this has the net result of reinforcing the mental conditioning that is responsible for the individuals being bound to samsara and to their limited identity as the body-mind complex. In other words, the thoughts, words, and deeds of the ego-bound individual tend to cause them to become even more deeply entrenched in this erroneous sense of limited identity. Sins leave their mark on the mind and are then carried around wherever one goes. This brings karma that only begets more of the same. The guru has the power to eradicate these samsaras and end the downward spiral of self-centeredness and consequent bondage once and for all. Since the embodied soul must think and act, let its every thought, word, and deed be dedicated to the guru rather than to the ego sense. Acting thus, the guru's power of grace is invoked, and that action, that word, or that thought becomes liberating instead of binding. 29. By drinking the water that has been used to wash the guru's feet, and by sprinkling some of it on one's head, one obtains the merits of bathing in all the sacred rivers. 30 and 31. In order to cross the ocean of samsara, to dry the lake of one's sins, the light of knowledge should be obtained by the water used to wash the guru's feet. The water from the guru's feet should be drunk in order to eliminate ignorance of one's true identity as the self, with a big S, which is the cause of birth and death. Now, before this Swami launches into Swami Anantanandagiri's commentary, kindly allow this Swami to testify in all truth. The very first time this Swami mind, which was not a Swami at the time, read those words, the immediate reaction was, ew! Okay? So, if you had a reaction like that, don't worry about it. Just fine. Now to the commentary. A question worth exploring is that of how literally we should take passages like these ones. Should we physically be drinking water that's been used to wash someone else's feet? As mentioned earlier, part of the significance of the guru's feet is symbolic. Throwing yourself at the feet of the guru is tantamount to surrendering the ego to the liberating power and intelligence of the universe itself, or the creator thereof, however you wish to understand that. Likewise, a powerful metaphor can be drawn from the imagery of drinking the water of the guru's feet. The disciple should always endeavor to imbibe the teaching of the guru and assimilate it into his or her own being. The disciples should always be receptive to the grace that eternally radiates from the guru. If you will recall, the guru's feet transmit a certain energy. More specifically, that energetic force is understood as grace. Water is widely understood to be a superb conductor of energy. Surrender to the guru is the drinking of the water from the guru's feet. The act of drinking, denoting a deep acceptance of the grace that the guru offers. But must we necessarily limit ourselves to one narrow interpretation of this idea? Donald Sister, the translator of this work, Acharya Paramachandra, makes the following anecdote about drinking of water. In recent times, a guru named Garma Ganga Karmakor mentioned a blissful experience her student had in Dubai after she washed her feet. And he stayed intoxicated in samadhi for quite some time. This guru happens to be our guru's friend. He initiated her interest in us and her the contact. Sri Ramana's close disciple and long-term attendant, called Ananamalai Swami, also had a similar experience. That having been said, grace is not limited to any particular anatomical feature of any one person. Whatever the guru gives, whether a glance, a touch, a bite of food, their praise, their criticism, or a whack on the head, it carries the blessing of Guru's grace, although the receptivity of the seeker is a factor as well. Conversely, it is unlikely that simply having a foot fetish is ever going to lead anybody to any sort of spiritual advancement. Kindly allow this Swami to share a bit from this Swami's time in training. This Swami's hair is pretty close to permanently parted down the middle from those cracks on the head. And while enduring these things, metaphorically, not physically in this Swami's case, although they do happen physically on occasion. It's very known within the Zen tradition. Masters will whack somebody so they break out of that stream of thought that is holding them back. Okay, and they have the opportunity to see clearly. It's metaphorically the same thing. But there is also very most certainly an energetic component, even when this is a metaphoric crack on the head. And while the crack on the head is being given, of course, the immediate response generally is not one of any appreciation whatsoever. Over time, and as one's consciousness expands, and they come to more clearly see the true nature of things, They come to be able to take on the quote that our guru is well known for. Every knock is a boost. And that's just quite simply the way it is. It is not done with ill intent. It is not done in an abusive way. It is done when when the guru realizes you are headed in the wrong direction and your further progress in that direction should be interrupted and redirected towards truth, towards the self, towards enlightenment and liberation. Number 32. One should take the water from the guru's feet, eat the food left over by the guru, meditate upon the guru's form, and should chant the guru's name or the guru mantra all the time. 33. Chanting the guru's name becomes the chanting of the name of the infinite Shiva. Meditating on the name of the guru becomes meditation upon Lord Shiva. The commentary. In collaborating on this translation, Acharya Padmadajendra shared these stories, which illustrate the above points. There have been a number of saints in the past and in the present who tried severe penance on one or some other form of God, but in the end, they all had to accept a living human guru for the final and stable self-realization to occur. In some cases, God himself guided his devotees to a human guru. One such example is Namadeva. He literally spent any amount of time he wished in the company of Vitala, a form of Vishnu. But in the end, Vitala told him to accept a guru, a living human guru, who alone could give him a universal vision of Vishnu. In recent times, a man named Papaji had to turn to Ramana Maharshi for a final abidance in the self, for stabilization. Although he could play with Krishna when he was a little boy and spent a lot of time in blissful samadhi states. She goes on to narrate that two saints of the lineage of Sri Ramana Maharshi, Lakshmana Swami and Saradama, quickly achieved self-realization by japa, which is the internal repetition, of their guru's name, which of course was Ramana and Lakshmana, respectively. She points out that Swami Muktananda constantly meditated on the form of his guru, Bhagwan Nityananda. Finally, she adds, Nisargadatta Maharaj simply believed the words of his guru and went about his mundane worldly duties. His self-realization also happened in a short time. Allow this, Swami, to share with you. Our guru's name, Swarupananda, is part of the mantra this Swami has running at all times. 34 through 36, Shiva says, I worship the guru. Even the dust from his feet is a bridge across the ocean of samsara. That's the cycle of birth and death. I bow to the guru, who is God himself, by whose grace all sorrows and attachments are destroyed. Simply by offering prostrations at the feet of such a guru, all desires are fulfilled. by obtaining his grace, the greatest of all ignorance is eliminated. The commentary. Even Shiva worships the guru and bows to the guru. The guru and God are one and the same. Thus, injunction is fulfilled that, quote, being Shiva, one should worship Shiva, end quote. The guru's feet are such a potent vortex of grace that even the dust from them is purported to possess liberating qualities. It is by this grace that ignorance is eliminated, desires fulfilled, attachments are destroyed, and one becomes unbound from the cycle of death and rebirth. And again, allow this Swami to testify. There is nothing like it. Those who are skeptical, well, of course, that's fully expected and understood. This Swami was once just as skeptical as you might be right now. But this Swami has seen the effect. This Swami has lived the effect and seen the effect in others. Therefore, no more room for doubt. 37 and 38. Shiva said, the merit obtained by abiding in the sacred city of Kashi and that of drinking the water of the sacred river Ganges can be obtained by simply drinking the water from the feet of the guru, who is Shiva himself. So it is ordained by Lord Brahma. Service to the guru is like being in Gaya, which is a place of pilgrimage where the deity worshipped there is Vishnu. The guru's body is like the imperishable banyan tree, which is worthy of worship. The guru's feet are like the feet of Vishnu. Anything that is offered at the guru's feet bestows infinite merit. The commentary. The merit obtained by dwelling in all the holiest of places in the world can be had by engaging in such seemingly simple and or weird activities as rendering service unto the guru or drinking the water that has been used to wash his or her feet, whether literally or metaphorically, as described previously. The guru is the sum total of all that is holy. The guru is the highest possible object of veneration. By the paradoxical decree of Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, an enlightened person may only be born of another enlightened person. Thus, the entirety of Lord Shiva's power of grace is invested in his manifestation as the individual who is fully awake. Kindly allow this Swami to take this another step. During these statements, you may have had thoughts of well-known, little-known rumors, innuendos, speculations about gurus who act what would be societally called inappropriately. Well, yes. You must come to understand that even though one who has fully and stably attained enlightenment and liberation will very often appear and act very much like any human. They will have likes and dislikes, preferences, perhaps aspects to their personality or their means of communication that are not friendly. Yep. That's the human aspect. We don't lose that when we become enlightened and liberated. We get to be both at the same time. Fully transcendent while fully immanent and embodied. Seeing through the limitation, but comfortably seated in the transcendent, infinite, eternal position, and understanding them both. That, it's not an either or. In the beginning, we have these either ors. You know, in the beginning of our sadhana or any type of esoteric practices, there are those moments when you lose touch with the physical world and the world of the mind and become transcendent. All well and good, very natural, nothing freakish about that. But you can't stay there. Now, even once you have gotten to the point where you're capable of bringing about that transcendent state at will, you still have stuff to do here, through the body, through the mind, by your thoughts, words, and actions. And those will continue to occur. It's just your perspective changes. Okay? Before we get to number 39, Sonic, let's go ahead and run the bottom of the hour song, and we'll be back here in a bit on Meditative Living.
Shiva, Om Namah Shivaya, Shiva Shiva, Om Namah Shivaya, Shiva Shiva, Om Namah Shivaya, Shiva Shiva.
Namaste and blessings. Welcome back to Meditative Living, exploring the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj, this Swami's Guru. Before we launch into number 39, kindly allow this Swami to point out, in this discourse between Shiva and Parvati, the term guru, 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 guru used over and over and over and over and over. But at different points, it is referring to what is the same essentially, but appearing different. It isn't always referring to the infinite, eternal source of pure, natural consciousness. Sometimes it's referring to the two-eyed, two-armed human form through which we learn to access that within ourselves. Okay? So a level of discernment is necessary to understand when is the reference to the physical body of a human who has the capacity to function as a guru, and when is it the infinite, the eternal, all that was, is, and ever will be. Okay? So you got to be able to sort that out, or some of this will sound, well, quite wrong, actually. So, be advised. Number 39. One should always meditate on the guru's form, repeat the guru's name or mantra, and follow the guru's orders. One should think of nothing other than the guru. The commentary. The closer one can approximate this directive, the more completely their every thought, word, and deed revolve around, and the more completely their senses become absorbed in Guru alone. There is nothing but Guru in reality. To achieve this ideal level of practice is to reinforce this sense in the individual that all of this, anything you can point to, anything you can say, anything you can think, anything you can experience is only Shiva, Guru, Self, Source, that to which you are attempting to return your awareness and understanding. And to burn off the erroneous sense of identification with the body-mind complex in the most rapid and straightforward way possible. Number 40, Shiva says, Brahman resides in the guru's mouth. By serving the guru in the same way that a devoted wife serves her husband, the disciple will attain Brahman. Swami Anantanandagiri's commentary. As you may recall, Brahman and Paramashiva are synonymous. In the process of emanation, or srishti, The universe is made manifest from Shiva, who is the infinite body of consciousness as pure, unmanifest potential. His manifest counterpart is his body, his consort, his capacity for actualization, his power, his Shakti. As the very first stirring of Shiva's intent, Shakti is born. The other of his three most transcendent powers are those of knowledge, jnana, and action, or kriya. Collectively, all of Shiva's multifarious powers, or Shaktis, also known as his manifestations, can be described as sound, or shabda, or speech, vak, in sense. When one is inclined to regard Shakti's most transcendent manifestations, as described above, in terms of sound, she is referred to as transcendent speech, paravak. As speech continues to radiate further and further from its origin in Shiva, it condenses into progressively more material and apparently more substantial and separate phenomena. In this way, the entire created order of things, from the gods and the heavens down to the earth plane and its inhabitants, issues forth from Paramashiva. In short, the universe is emitted from its source as speech. It is by the power of speech that the entire universe exists. The inverse process, that of withdrawal, is that of the universe's absorption back into Shiva. Of particular relevance to our discussion is the matter of the individual's perception of a differentiated universe full of subjects and objects resolving into the perception of only unity. When this occurs, one rests in the enlightened state of Sahaja Samadhi. This is due to the process of withdrawal at the scale of the individual. This process, too, hinges upon speech. In this case, it is the speech of the guru that empowers the process. This is what is meant when it is said that Brahman resides in the mouth of the guru. At the end of the Spandakarika, which is another Kashmir Shaivite text, we find a description of this process, which is also framed in terms of speech. And here it is. I pay homage to that wonderful speech of my guru, which is like a boat for crossing the fathomless ocean of doubt, and is full of words which yield wonderful meaning in the case of the guru. I offer my reverential prayer to Spanda, the throb or pulsation within consciousness, in the form of Paravak, the supreme divine eye consciousness, which acts like a boat in crossing the fathomless ocean of doubt regarding my essential nature. So, the process of resolving the limited ego sense back into Shiva from whence it first originated hinges upon the guru's speech. But this isn't all we are told here. This shloka, or verse, also informs us that the disciple attains Brahman by serving the guru as a devoted wife serves her husband. In other words, self-effort on the part of the disciple is also necessary. The guru casts the seed, but the disciple must make the ground fit to receive it. If the ground is compact and full of weeds, how can the tree of knowledge take root? How is the fruit of self-realization to be born if the ground is not made arable? The guru blazes a trail, but it must be traversed by the disciple's own 2 feet. The way to do this, most simply put, is to serve the guru faithfully. Now, let this Swami jump in here again. This does not mean you allow yourself to be taken advantage of. Any guru worth their salt would have no interest in doing such a thing in the first place. Their entire purpose and function is to assist you to attain the very same level of consciousness they have. It's not about collecting followers. A master's work is creating more masters. That's work. The one and only great work going on this planet. Once one has attained and become stable in the supreme consciousness, it becomes then the duty of quite a number of those people, though not all, to assist others to do the same. And that can be done in many, many, many ways. And there are many different traditions and lineages and systems and all of that. Okay? There's something for everyone if they will walk that inner path with the assistance of the outer instructor, teacher, master, guru. Okay? Number 41. Shiva says, renouncing one's order of life, their caste, and their reputation in society, the disciple should take shelter in the guru. Now, let's discuss the order of life, the stages of life in the Indian system. There are 4 stages of life called ashramas, prescribed by the Brahmanism of India's Vedic era. 1, the brahmachari stage, which is a student of the Vedas. 2, the griha, the householder stage. When the individual comes of age, they may either remain in the brahmachari stage or take to married life and commerce as a householder. Stage 3, Vanaprastha, the forest-dwelling hermit. After a man's children had left home and received their education, it was recommended he adopt the life of a forest-dwelling hermit for the sake of focusing exclusively on spirituality and meditation. And then finally, the 4th state, the sannyasin. This is when the hermit becomes established in self-realization. He becomes a sannyasin, an abandoner of all worldly concerns. Sometimes he is encouraged to resort to the life of a wandering beggar at this point. Now, within the Swami tradition, it is at that level where you become Swami. And you go through the Vedic ceremony to take on Swami-ness. Now, about caste. There were four castes which comprised the social hierarchy of Brahmanic India. Number one, the Brahmin, with an I, Brahmin. This, the highest caste, was the culture's priestly class. Number two, the Kshatriya. This caste was composed of the culture's warriors and rulers. Number three, the Vaishya. This caste made up the culture's working class, who were engaged in activities such as commerce, farming, etc. Number four, the Sudra caste. The duty of this caste, it was understood, was to be of service to the other three castes. Originally, now, here we go. Much is made of the caste system of India. Let's talk about it in the way it was originally done, not the way it is currently used to discriminate. Originally, these groupings merely reflected the occupation that the individual took up based on his or her temperament and inclinations. Many sages revered in India were considered to be Brahmin, even though they were born to Shudra parents. However, the family one was born into eventually came to be the sole factor in determining which caste one belonged to. If one was born to Shudra or Vaishya parents, they were barred from engaging in political, martial, or spiritual pursuits. For anyone who wasn't born into the Brahmin or Kshatriya castes, it was a capital offense to either hear or recite the Vedas. Women, once highly revered and respected, also came to be confined to low caste societal roles. Even during this period of institutional corruption, permeating every tier of society, perfected beings, the Siddhas, continued to walk the earth, untainted by the delusive notion of I as distinct from an other. The true Siddhas never ceased to serve as a beacon to those who were ripe for self-realization, despite the fact that they commonly suffered persecution at the hands of the orthodoxy for their defiance of convention. They continued to uphold the injunction that the real Brahmin is one who is called to inquire into the true nature of the self. They knew that this work could be undertaken regardless of which stage of life the individual found themselves in when the inspiration struck. It is in the spirit of these Siddha saints of bygone era that this shloka, or verse, of the Guru Gita reminds a seeker that the self is the birthright of all beings. The Guru is the instrument of its realization. The sole qualification entitling one to make use of what a guru has to offer is having the good fortune, or karma, of being exposed to one who is qualified to carry out that function and having the good sense to accept their help. Sometimes society helps people along the guru path. Sometimes it endeavors to distract them from it. Either way, the guru is the highest authority and the highest path. One who is called to the higher path should not be deterred by the expectations of others. The choice should not be left up to convention, because convention is entirely unreliable. Regardless of how it affects one's reputation, despite whatever rewards or penalties society may or may not impose, it is the pursuit of self-realization that is in one's best interest. To ignore this work is to perpetuate and extend one's own suffering. Jesus said, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, that which you do not bring forth will destroy you." As the Guru Gita implies here in number 41, it is hypocritical, to promote the goal of renunciation by means of societal pressure. What kind of renunciation is it to live one's life according to the expectations of others? How can one renounce the world when they can't even let go of their attachment to what other people think of them? One whose temperament naturally fits into the template offered by the Ashrama system, of course, could benefit by following the model it offers. However, the whole thing can be bypassed at any stage of life by simply rejecting everything of the world and taking shelter at the feet of the guru. This is the highest embodiment of renunciation. Tomorrow is never guaranteed. Therefore, one who has the opportunity to follow the guru path should not wait until they find themselves in another stage of life or for a better birth in order to do so. There is no time more appropriate than now. No birth more auspicious than that in which one meets a guru. One need not wait until they are older or until the kids are out of the house to perform sadhana. The best time is always now. Don't waste an opportunity. The firm resolve to reject any excuse to postpone the work of remembering the self is what truly makes one a sannyasi. Next week, we'll take off with number 42 from the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj. This is Swami Shivananda. Thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be of service. Namaste and blessings.